The prices at the pumps remind us every day that the United States is engaged in a war with Iran, but Central Floridians are beginning to feel the effects of inflating consumer costs beyond the pump. It's Thursday, April 2nd, 2026, and you're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Richard Copeland, sitting in for Sharon Stone. On today's Engage, we'll look at the effect these skyrocketing oil prices are having on everything from the food in your fridge to the drugs in your medicine cabinet to the spending behavior of the tourists driving our economy. And later, we'll check in with Are We There Yet? Host Brendan Byrne on the launch of the Artemis II mission. We'll visit Pet Alliance's new shelter, and we'll meet the members of Florida Sumo, some oversized wrestlers ready for battle and definitely ready to eat. But first, as of today, crude oil futures are trading at $111 a barrel, and the average price per gallon of gas in Florida is $4.23. But our dependency on petroleum extends beyond our cars. Without oil, our agricultural industry would collapse.
Fertilizer, pesticides, these are all oil-based products. Then they're going to produce as far as their crops, and they need equipment. They need irrigation as far as to be able to do that. And that also is an oil-based types of products. And then they need to distribute it. And more times than not, they're going to need a refrigerated truck as far as to do that, especially if they're going to be going across the country coming from Central Florida. So that refrigerated truck now needs an additional diesel engine that's going to refrigerate and keep cool the products in the back of the trailer on top of their diesel fuel that's required to move the truck.
That's Andrew Johnson, an associate lecturer of supply chain and operations management at UCF. Johnson predicts we will see impacts from the war in Iran in the housing and construction industries as well.
Oil is embedded into every building material, whether it's asphalt, roofing, plastics, your insulation that's required for your house. All of that is going to be, you know, is produced using oil-based types of products. And home construction costs, you know, can rise between 5 and 10% during these fuel spikes. So when you have these high costs of housing, then, you know, another option may be that consumers will just rent because of how expensive that it is.
Johnson also says consumers will definitely feel the financial hit because of the proliferation of plastics in our lives.
One of the biggest kind of hidden impacts of fuel prices is going to be packaging. Everything is packaged in an oil-based type of product, everything. So what happens is that when they refine this into these other types of byproducts, whether it's benzene, polyurethane, resin, these are products that are in everything that we use every single day, right? So clothing prices are going to be impacted. Synthetic fibers like polyester, right? So more than half of clothing today is made from these petroleum-based materials.
Sharon Stone spoke at length with Andrew Johnson, who went on to talk about the effect of the oil crunch on the region's tourism.
Higher fuel prices, you know, it's not going to stop tourism. You know, that demand is always going to be there. However, the behavior of consumers are going to change. Right? They're not going to spend as much. So let's just get people here first. So let's just say we have a family from Seattle that are coming to Disney, right? So we need to get them here first. So how does that happen? Well, more than likely that they're going to take as far as airfare, right? So jet fuel cost, that is going to increase airfares. Now, once they get here, we need to move them around. Whether it's going to be rental cars, ride share, or shuttle, that is all going to be as far as increase because of the price of oil. Now, we get them into the parks. Well, you know, now we have to operate and provide that experience to the consumer. So hotels and parks are energy and logistics kind of heavy systems. One is laundry. Right. So massive energy is required, and as well as water usage is required to run all the laundry services. The food supply chains, bringing all the food that's coming inbound, all those inbound deliveries to the parks. The cleaning supplies that are needed. Many of these are going to be petroleum based types of products. The landscaping, the maintenance, the internal transportation, all of that requires petroleum based products. So all of that, we're going to see a key shift in behavioral spending. Right. So again, visitors are going to come, but they're just going to spend differently. Fewer restaurant meals, potentially. Maybe they don't buy as many souvenirs as they once planned on doing. Maybe fewer add-on experiences, tours, upgrades, and things like that. Again, the numbers will be here, but the spending is going to be less.
Could all of this end with the opening of the strait tomorrow?
If it opens tomorrow, it will not end. Once they open it, it typically takes a few weeks, between 2 and 6 weeks, as far as for that type of ripple effect to where we now see it. You know, again, you know, we're just seeing that the price, you know, at a stoplight, we're seeing at the gas stations, that it does not end there, right? It's only the beginning. So having a $4 a gallon fuel, when I see that, I see, all right, well, what's coming next? Because that is just kind of the tipping point. It's really a good indicator of our economy. It really is a good indicator of what is going to happen. And because, again, we're so reliant on petroleum-based products that there's no way that we're not going to feel the pinch of that.
What does this blockade tell us about the precariousness of the global economy? Can we make adjustments so that such a large portion of the global economy is not just dependent on what is a relatively tiny shipping lane? Something so small is having such an impact here.
You're absolutely right. I'm looking at a real-time view of it through maritime.com, and there's no ships going through it. You see ships, there's some ships are Iranian ships, but that's it. They're all bottlenecked at the bottom of each end of the arch. They're all bottlenecked there. Now, so what's happening is, one of these straits, you know, ever get bottlenecked that this way, then shippers have to make decisions whether they're now going to go ahead and go around all of Africa. That is an option, and we've seen some shippers do that. But what that does, it takes time, right? It takes an enormous amount of time to be able to go through those. Some shippers do that, and some shippers are just waiting it out and then seeing, as far as, you know what, it's going to open soon, so we're just going to kind of plant ourselves here. And as far as wait that out, but as far as, you know, mitigation steps, it's all about trying to reroute.
What are your biggest concerns looking at the totality of the situation?
As far as my biggest concern is awfully, when is this going to end? Because the longer this prolongs, the more time it's going to take for the globe and specifically for the U.S. economy to be able to kind of right the ship, if you will. But one thing that I do take kind of solace in is at least we're moving product. At least the supply chains are moving. It's just not moving at the pace that we're used to. You know, we're used to just in time. We're used to having, you know, product on our shelves and the amount that we needed to have on our shelves to be able to meet that daily demand, but not have too much to where, you know, now you're paying these exorbitant kind of handling and carrying cost of having products sit on a shelf. Because just like with COVID taught us here in the US, you know, a great many lessons. As far as having additional suppliers, having additional manufacturing plants, not in one country, having multiple different countries that can manufacture some of our goods or some of the components that we absolutely need, and not having it all kind of like our eggs in one basket, if you will. And what we learned, and we didn't know, that 97% of our pharmaceutical products were coming from China. And again, it's not something against China. It is that we're just manufacturing in one country and we need to diversify that. And so I think that a lesson that can be learned here is trying to diversify maybe transportation modes, maybe different transportation routes. But that all comes with the cost analysis with companies, whether it's more beneficial for them to go around and go extra miles when something maybe like this will never happen again. But we need to have better risk mitigation steps.
Beyond the consumer economy, Central Florida's manufacturing community is preparing to see costs increase. From materials to operations to shipping, the impact will be multidimensional for businesses like Lakeland's Industrial Plastic Systems, a producer of tanks, pipes, and ducts for plumbing applications. Their products are primarily made of fiberglass, which is problematic, as IPS's president, Michael Brown, explains.
Fiberglass and composites manufacturing is petroleum-based. And so any change in or disruption in the supply chain affects us by rising costs. And it is significant in the last month because of the war and the Strait of Hormuz interruptions. And that was an immediate price increases by all of our raw materials manufacturers and suppliers.
Brown is already seeing increases in the costs of the petrochemicals Industrial Plastic Systems uses to make their products. I asked him, by how much?
The low end right now has been 8% up to almost 30%. So that's a universal increase for the resin cost, but we're reinforced plastic as fiberglass is. So the fibers have been affected, but not to the extent that the petroleum-based resins have.
We are hearing of price increases in plastic products in other parts of the world, 30% in New Zealand, analysts are predicting a doubling of plastic products prices in Indonesia. Are you prepared for material cost increase of these levels? Is there a break point?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, I try to be positive about these things, and price increases, as long as they're done across the board, what's the expression? Rising sea lifts all boats. So everybody's in the same predicament that we would be. And so it will just manifest itself in higher costs for everybody. Higher prices probably means lower demand. And so it's not then affecting the decreased supply that much. So basic economics.
You're not seeing a throttling of inventory insofar as supply?
No, but we've been warned that the supply is getting tighter. And that happens as soon as price increases are announced. Everybody tries to stock up locally. And so that just wipes out the supply that the local distributors might have for the resins or the raw materials.
Have you been stockpiling product?
We have. as best to our ability, yes. We're restricted on how much raw materials we can have on site, but we're trying to maximize that right now, and trying to purchase inventory that could be held at the distribution site right now.
Are these price increases being reflected in your outbound pricing yet?
Yes, they are. So this is immediately taken into account for new quotes, but when we get a request for a quote and quote a project, will be as low as 14 to 21 days after they receive the quote in order for those prices to remain. And if it goes longer through procurement on some of these larger companies, the project may have to be re-quoted.
What are you hearing from other manufacturers in the region?
Same situation. We are unique in that our product that we produce, the tanks and pressure pipe for desalinization plants, things like this, we're one of the only ones in Florida that are doing exactly what we're doing. But there are plenty of others in through Louisiana and Texas, many more. And, you know, everybody's getting impacted very similarly, you know, and taking somewhat the same approach that we are, and everybody doing it at the same time. means who's the fastest to pull the trigger on some big purchases before these price increases take effect.
Can I ask how many employees there are at Industrial Plastic Systems?
I believe we're at 23 now, so we're a small company. But we've had great growth over the last 10 years and want to continue to do that. And so it's a lot of planning, and this is an unexpected twist for the first quarter. But we're still seeing good demand, so that helps in the short-term issue of supply if the demand continues for our product anyway. I know that similar but different manufacturers, particularly pool and spa manufacturers and boat manufacturers, have already been greatly impacted. One of the reasons why there's so much inventory for us now, because they have already noticed quite a demand drop in their products, pools and boats in particular.
From your employees, are they voicing any concerns yet? Asking any questions about this?
No. We try to be communicative of what we're doing. Our demand remains high, so that's a good thing. But we went from almost 2.5 years of hiring, you know, especially when the right person comes through the door where we've hired. So last week we stopped that. So we're taking applications, certainly, but we're not hiring for the first time in over 2.5 years.
If the blockade in the Persian Gulf were to end today, how long would it take you to bring the books back to normal, to see pricing renormalized?
That's a good question. I would venture to say within 3 months, we would have enough flow. You know, the news seems to concentrate on crude oil. You know, an adjacent discussion usually is on our industry is more affected in petrochemical, because not only is it the petroleum-based resins that we have, but a lot of chemicals also flow through the Straits of Hormuz, and that's also affecting us almost as much as the crude issue, the petroleum issue.
Are you concerned that this conflict could be prolonged?
I don't think that there's any indication that it's going to be prolonged, but It certainly would be cause for concern if it was extended. That would be no good for anybody, I believe.
Have you visualized worst case scenarios?
Not at this point. I remain positive that that this will be sorted, and certainly something had to be done after 47 years of continuing issues with Iran. But I certainly hope it's solved and sorts itself out very soon. Everybody's affected at the gas pumps, and the gas pumps are a good indication. You know, you've seen over 50% rise in prices over the last month and a half. So we see this not only in our raw materials, but also every delivery has fuel service surcharges now. It's not only not good for the manufacturers, it's not good for anyone. So just hopeful that it sorts itself out real soon.
That was Michael Brown, president of Industrial Plastic Systems in Lakeland. The pharmaceutical industry is not immune to these market forces. Petroleum plays a large role in the manufacturing of the drugs in our medicine cabinets, specifically the low-cost generic drugs favored by most insurance carriers. Amarjeet Kaur is the owner and lead pharmacist at Harrison's, an independent pharmacy in Orlando employing four people. Kaur got her start as a CVS pharmacist, but bought Harrison's specifically to connect with her patients and community beyond the constraints of a corporate culture. Low-cost generic drugs make up 90% of Harrison Pharmacy's business, and Kaur is already seeing increases of up to 7% on wholesale drug prices. And additional shipping charges are being assessed to compensate for gas and diesel prices. Additionally, Kaur explains that the elements that make up the drugs, active pharmaceutical ingredients, called APIs, are also products of petroleum.
APIs are the active ingredient that help forms the tablets, capsules, injectable medications, and also they are the part that makes the therapeutic effect. Typically, these are the highly purified chemical components, and roughly 40% of the medications that are produced in the U.S., they need these products, and also China and India, they need the APIs made. And with this oil disruption, it will affect the APIs and overall production of all these medications that we need, especially the generics. And also the fact that we need to pack the medication, the packing material is also going to be affected. So everything combined is dependent on these petroleums right at the moment.
Industry analysts in the United Kingdom are warning of a pending crisis in that country. Now, without sounding like an alarmist, are you concerned about a larger supply crisis in the United States? Is there the potential to see this snowball through the summer?
I would say yes, if the conditions stay the way they are at the moment. At this moment, I hope and I feel that we have enough supplies for 3 to 6 months at least, and we should be fine if the conditions improve. But if they don't improve, then we will start seeing the heat by summertime. And preparing at a local level, trying to talk to other independents or other pharmacists to see what are other options at this moment.
Why will this impact Harrison's Pharmacy differently than a chain like CVS or Walgreens?
It will, of course, affect independent pharmacies like mine because we don't have such a big buying power like CVS's and Walgreens. For that, I am proactively working on combining local independent groups where we can increase our buying power and have more medications on shelves, and also tapping into our savings a little bit more than needed so that we have enough supplies on shelves for patients when they need it. Independent pharmacies are in a very tricky situation where they don't have a lot of buying power, and also the reimbursement rates coming in late or not enough. We don't have extra cash to go buy medications that will last us a year or so. But right now I am buying enough for next 3 to 6 months. And also I'm speaking to my patients, making sure they are comfortable with the recommendations that might happen if we are not able to bring their medications on time or because of the shortage if they're not available.
Are they beginning to voice concerns to you?
Yes, I have had more than 4 to 5 patients in last 10 to 12 days who have come in and just randomly asked that, what if I don't get my medication? What will happen? And of course, we have, you know, some solutions for them, and I'm trying to make sure that they stay calm. This is not a panicking time yet. There are still supplies. We're in a good situation at the moment still, but the patients are voicing their concerns, and they need to know what will happen if their medication is not there. Because mostly everybody takes generics, you know, and generics are the ones that are on stake right now.
To what extent could these patients expect either their insurance company, Medicare, Medicaid to make up any differences, any of that increase in prices?
Patients would hope that the Medicare and Medicaid would cover the difference, but I foresee that it will be either the independents or pharmacies in general taking the loss, or going back to the patients and explaining it to them that because certain product is more expensive, insurance is not paying for it, and they might have to take the loss and pay for the medication or look for alternatives.
Amarjeet Kaur is the owner and pharmacist at Harrison's Pharmacy in Orlando. We want to hear how these oil prices are impacting you. We see the effects at the pump. Where else are you experiencing financial strain as a result of the war in Iran? You can connect with us via email at engage@cfpublic.org, or you can send us a talkback on the Free Central Florida Public Media app. In the menu, select Send Us a Talkback, record your question or feedback, then hit Send. There are plans to redraw congressional district lines here in Florida. We want to hear how you feel about that, how that could impact your community, your vote, your representation. We want to remind you to mark your calendars for Thursday, April 16th at 6 p.m. when you can engage in a discussion about Florida's redistricting plans at our next Engage in the Community event. We'll have a panel of community members sharing ideas and fielding questions at the Osceola Council on Aging in Kissimmee. More information is available at our website, cfpublic.org. Up next, the Artemis II mission launched successfully last night. We'll find out where our intrepid explorers are at this stage of the mission and what to expect in the next few days. You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media.
The Wrap is a podcast from Central Florida Public Media, curating the top Central Florida news stories and in-depth reporting each week. Join me, Brendan Byrne, as I bring you news headlines, deep reporting dives, and insightful conversations from the news team. A new episode of The Wrap every Friday morning. Get it wherever you get your podcasts.
You are listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Richard Copeland, sitting in for Sharon Stone. Ahead on the program, while Central Florida may be the nexus of WWE wrestling, a different type of wrestling is taking place at the Shendai Dojo in Orlando.
I was up against a much larger opponent because I was 330 at the time. I'm almost 400 now, so I've put on quite a bit since then. But I was up against a much larger opponent, and he just steamrolled me. He came right off the line and just walked right through me. I wasn't even there.
Coming up, we'll meet the members of Florida Sumo, but first.
And here we go. 10, 9, 8, 7. RS-25 engines lit. 4, 3, 2, 1. Booster ignition. And lift off.
And with that, the Artemis II rocket took off from the Kennedy Space Center, topped by the Orion space capsule containing 4 brave explorers. Humans will embark on a lunar mission for the first time in more than 53 years. Are we there yet? Host Brendan Byrne was on site for the launch, and he joins us. Brendan, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Glad to be here, Richard. Thanks for having me.
First off, I watched that video that you took from your position of the launch. I've heard it's been an experience, but my headphones were literally rattling on my head as I watched. Can you describe what it's like to see the most powerful rocket ever built launch?
Yeah, you are absolutely right when you say it is an experience, right? You don't see launches, you don't hear launches, you feel launches. And when that countdown clock hit zero, there were so many people out at the press site where I was, about 4 miles away from the launch pad. So they were counting down. You could hear them, the excitement in their voices. And then you see the bright lights of the solid rocket boosters ignite. And then the rocket lifts off and it's quiet. We don't hear anything. That's because it's so far away and sound travels a little bit slower than what our eyes can see. And then all of a sudden you are hit with this, the best way to describe it is these solid rocket boosters just crack the air. And you just hear this crack and this rattle and this rumble. I feel my clothes kind of moving when it does get to this particular altitude. And really the intensity has maxed out. It is just absolutely incredible. You know, there's not much to compare this to.
It seemed as though everything went according to plan prior to launch. The only hiccup appeared to be a power source glitch in the craft's abort system that was quickly ironed out. Otherwise, was this a textbook launch?
Yeah, I think there were only two little glitches, the battery issue that you mentioned, and there was a separate battery issue that was I believe it was a sensor issue. But yeah, this was a picture perfect countdown. I mean, there was no holds other than the ones that were already built in. None of the issues that have plagued the Artemis 1 launch and then the previous tests of the Artemis 2 launch, like that leaky hydrogen, there was no leaks. The issue with the helium system was resolved. And this was a surprisingly very smooth countdown for a vehicle that is only launched one time before. We got to remember, this is only the second time NASA is launching a space launch system. So this is a very new vehicle on a test flight. This is a really, really smooth countdown.
So we're nearly at the 24-hour mark in this mission. Where are we in the game plan? What are these astronauts doing as we're speaking?
You know, in their first hours, they were working. The vehicle separated from a stage of the rocket that helped boost them into their orbit. It started in a very high Earth orbit. And they took this piece of hardware that they didn't need anymore to boost them anywhere. And they took manual control of the Orion spacecraft and literally flew it around this rocket stage that no longer had any fuel in it. And this was to test the handling of the Orion spacecraft if astronauts need to take manual control during docking operations or flying operations. And pilot Victor Glover said, you know, it handled pretty good. They're going to send all this data back down to Earth for ground teams to help better the control system for future missions, because Orion will have to dock with a lunar lander. It's going to do that autonomously, but there may be times where astronauts need to step in. So they need to know that they're able to fly the Orion spacecraft. And it was a very, very good indication overnight that they were able to do that. They also tested key systems on the life support system, the oxygen system, temperature control, and the toilet as well. And they got some rest. So they went to sleep for a bit and then they woke back up and then they're off to the moon. That is the next stage. They'll have a few days of travel through deep space before they arrive.
So how long will it take them to get from Earth to the moon? How long will that take compared to how long it took Apollo astronauts to reach the moon 50 plus years ago?
We're looking at about 6 days until they get to the farthest part of their trip, where they're whipping around the moon. Comparing this to Apollo, though, you know, Apollo 8 did a lunar flyby. Apollo 13, unfortunately, had to do a lunar flyby. But the other Apollo landing missions went into an orbit around the moon. And they parked their orbit a little under 100 miles from the surface of the moon. With Orion's flyby, it is going to be looping out about 5,000 miles beyond the far side of the moon. So this will set the record for the farthest a human being has ever been into deep space. So that is going to be really, really cool. And scientists are really excited about this because they will be using their eyes to check out sites on the far side of the moon that have never before seen by humans. So they've been trained by geologists to look for specific things that may be of interest and mark them and take photographs and send them back. They'll also get to experience a lunar eclipse from the moon, which is pretty wild. And then during this travel time, so they'll have like 3 days to get there, 3 days to come back. They'll be doing all sorts of experiments on themselves, on the hardware. They will be testing the radiation effects on their bodies, the effects of deep space on their bodies. They're equipped with all sorts of different sensors. And then they've also taken like their cells from their organs and they've put them on these little tiny medical chips. And they've put these chips in all sorts of different cracks and crevices of Orion to see what radiation might do to human tissue, even if we don't tell what happens with the four test pilots that are doing it right now. So there's a lot of stuff that's being done here to help with future missions to the moon that will eventually land.
So 3 days out, 3 days back, you know, almost a week for these four astronauts. Can you describe the interior of the Orion space capsule? How much space do these people have to work with? Is it going to be like we used to see on the shuttle missions where, you know, there's room to float around the cabin?
Yeah, they'll be floating around the cabin. It is a bit cramped, it appears, but it's certainly a lot more space than the Apollo astronauts had when they were there. A lot of their stuff kind of folds up where it needs to go. You know, their toilet is packed into the side of the spacecraft. But they've got some room to work around. But yeah, it certainly is a very, very tight space. It's not like they're on the International Space Station, like three of these astronauts have already spent time on.
Well, I wasn't going to go there, but since you mentioned toilets twice, Brendan, I got to ask, there has been glitches with the sanitation system. What do we know about that? And how much of an inconvenience could that pose for these astronauts?
Yeah, so I would be offended if you didn't ask me about this, Richard. So one of the first things that they did when they got to orbit was test out those life support systems that I mentioned and test out the toilet. And yeah, there was an issue with it. They were able to do, let's see how I can make this safe for radio. They were able to do solids, but liquids a no-go. But they were able to fix that, basically just kind of reset the system. The toilet, I am happy to report, now works. There are redundancies built in, albeit not fun ones, where they would have had to collect what would normally go in the toilet into bags and stow those. But that's what the Apollo astronauts had to do. So, you know, when going to the moon, a toilet is a luxury.
In my book, it's a critical system. Brendan Byrne, host of Central Florida Public Media's Are We There Yet? Thank you so much for flushing out the details of this launch for us.
Very nice. Happy to be here, Richard.
The weather in Orlando was perfect this past Saturday. Low 70s by 10 a.m. without a cloud in the sky. Just the right conditions to spend the day with kittens and puppies. So I headed over to the grand opening of the Pet Alliance's brand new shelter on South John Young Parkway. The Kylie J. Capri Campus and Edward H. Hensley Adoption Center will be able to shelter, medically treat, and provide adoption services for 275 cats and dogs, an increase from the previous capacity of about 150 animals. The expansion is a win for the nonprofit that has been caring for dogs and cats in Orlando since 1937, especially after a devastating Wednesday night 6 years ago.
We do know now that 25 dogs were rescued, 19 cats were taken out. Two of them were found alive inside the building. One of those cats was pregnant. Sadly, many of the cats did not survive.
During a late September night in 2021, an electrical fire tore through the Pet Alliance's shelter facility near the mall at Millennia. 26 dogs were safely evacuated, but 17 cats perished in the fire that left the Alliance without a shelter. The 5,000 square foot shelter was destroyed, but in late 2024, ground was broken to build a new, bigger campus. Brandy Bennett is the Pet Alliance's Director of Development.
This new facility is 25,000 square feet, and it doubles in medical size to what we had before. We can hold up to 275 animals here. We can save the lives of multiple animals on a daily. This is a great opportunity for us to reach out to the community and bond with them and get these new animals new homes.
The Capri Campus shelter is five times bigger than the old one, a necessary upgrade as the region's population has swelled by nearly 400,000 residents since 2015, as has the need for animal services.
That's why we doubled our medical facilities here. That's a place where we can go in and take care of these medical needs. Spay and neutering, vaccinations, small mass removals, things like that before these animals can get adopted. A lot of people surrender their pets to us because they can't afford medical. And this is an opportunity for us to take care of the medical situations and then get these animals into loving homes.
The affordability of medical care that Bennett mentioned is a substantial cause for pet abandonment. Luz Fajardo recently relocated to Polk County from Orlando. She works with the Pet Alliance's TNR team.
TNR is Trap, Neuter, Return.
Fajardo is carrying a teacup mixed breed with buggy eyes named Layla over her shoulder, as if she's burping a baby. She can relate to the financial issues that can come with the medical needs of pets.
Especially when it comes to specialized services. For example, for her, Layla has a level 5 heart murmur. And if I go to a specialist, it's about $1,800 worth of tests for her, just for us to end up in the same conclusion she's going to pass of this. So that's the struggle right now. The vet fees are very, very big. And 1 year with all of my cats, I have 7 cats and 2 dogs, I had an $18,000 vet bill. So I had to get another job in order to pay that off. So right now, there are some vets that are willing to work, but they're being bought out by larger veterinary, you know, associations, and their prices go higher. Some of the fees that they apply, it's insane.
As much as people love their pets, the financial burden of veterinary costs often lead those owners to leave their dogs and cats in shelters, or worse yet, just abandon them outdoors. Fajardo explains why this is problematic, especially with feline populations.
Cats outside procreate multiple times a year and they have multiple litters. So that causes not only an overpopulation of cats outside, that can also, you know, cause issues with birds, but also get hit by vehicles. They could cause accidents, and nobody's caring for them, and they get sick. Also, sometimes if they have, like, for example, FELV, that's highly contagious with the cats, sometimes you have to, unfortunately, euthanize those cats.
For the cats that do find a bed at the new Pet Alliance shelter, life is about to substantially change for the better. Eileen Gregory of Winter Park is a Pet Alliance volunteer working in the cat wing of the shelter, tending to a litter of orphans.
These little kittens lost their mom, so they're being bottle fed, and they have to be kept incubated, so they're being kept at a certain temperature, nice and warm, and we bottle feed them, and we rub their tummy to make sure that their muscles are working well, their digestive tract is working well, and they're breathing well. The ones in the back are about 1 month old. The ones to the left were just found, actually, yesterday, and just came into us.
Kittens are a hot commodity in Pet Alliance shelters. They practically fly off the shelves as potential forever families gather to watch the feline siblings frolicking over a length of yarn.
The kittens usually stay for 1 day, maybe 2. Sometimes they'll come in, and as soon as they're adoptable, that is, they've been fixed and they've had their shots and they've had their microchip, then they often will go within an hour. Right now, it's not kitten season, so they're in really high demand. During kitten season, they'll maybe last 2 or 3 days. So.
When is kitten season?
So kitten season is about 4 months after it starts to get warm. So we will probably start to see them coming in maybe late April, but more likely May and June, and then throughout the entire summer. And last year, because our weather was so warm, we had kitten season all the way through December.
Cats were busy that year.
Very busy.
Over on the canine side of the shelter, I found Molly Charles, who drove down from Jacksonville with her kids, looking for a dog to adopt, albeit under some unusual circumstances.
My niece, her 12-year-old dog, died. She doesn't know. We didn't tell her yet. So we're looking and hoping she finds something that she likes and we'll probably be adopting. So we're going to have to tell her eventually because she's asking us to put up lost dog photos. But if she falls in love today, it might soften the blow.
Molly may be one of the first adoptive pet parents to leave the new Pet Alliance shelter with an addition to the family. But there will be many more visiting to find new friends in the coming years.
Oh my goodness, aren't they gorgeous?
Coming up, the members of Florida Sumo eat, wrestle, and eat some more. We'll meet them on the other side of the break. You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media.
There's a lot going on in space, from efforts to land astronauts on the moon
and liftoff of Artemis 1
to answering the age-old question, are we alone in the universe?
Wouldn't you want to know if there was life on another planet?
Are We There Yet? Explores space exploration every Tuesday at 6:30 here on Central Florida Public Media.
You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Richard Copeland, sitting in for Sharon Stone. Sumo wrestling is a strange sport. While it's huge in Japan, it never really took root in America, which seems odd for a country so enamored with combative sports. After all, we're the country that produced Muhammad Ali, Hulk Hogan, Chuck Norris, and the UFC. But there are sumo enthusiasts in the U.S., and around here, they gather as Florida Sumo.
So,
the club meets at Shindai Dojo, a martial arts studio hidden in a small industrial business park just off Mercy Drive. The walls are lined with receptacles containing numerous martial arts staffs and swords. Pool noodles form a ring in the middle of a large mat sitting on the floor. This is the sumo arena. Alejandro Alex Santana is the coach and leader of the Orlando chapter of Florida Sumo. He was a Division II athlete in college, competing in both football and track and field. But it was the scene from a popular heist film that connected Alex to sumo wrestling.
Back in the early 2010s, I think it was Ocean's 13 that came out. There's a scene in there in the casino where they have a sumo tournament. In that scene is a gentleman called Biamba. Biamba, rest his soul, passed away a few years ago, was kind of like one of the big people in amateur sumo here in the U.S., and I just started looking him up, looked up a couple of different sumo websites, really got into it, and then the gentleman who actually founded Florida Sumo, Cornelius Booker, found him on Facebook through like a Facebook group page of like people who like sumo wrestling. We started talking. At the time, there was nothing, so this is like 2011, there's no sumo in Florida, really nothing past like Texas, if that. And then over the past like 10 years, it's just really picked up. And now like our club has grown from just in Panama City to a big location here in Orlando. We have members in Daytona, members in Miami, members in Gainesville. So like it's like quadrupled just in the past like 3 years.
Florida Sumo welcomes anybody of anybody type to join. Santana says there are two types of people who show interest in sumo.
Football players, they tend to be the first ones that go, oh wow, I can kind of do some of the same things. And then when they kind of see it's a little different, they still fall in love with it. Obviously, people who wrestled, people who did, you know, grappling sports, who are trying to find something else. And then one of the biggest populations of sumo wrestlers, not just in Florida, but everywhere else, are people that did zero sports at all. People that were just, you know, quote unquote, the nerds in school, who really couldn't do any sports because they felt like they're outcasts. They kind of find sumo, and sumo is kind of like an outcast sport, you know, because it's different and niche and weird. And they just go, that's kind of cool, that's like me. And they tend to fall in love with it. So those are really the two big groups. If people who've never done sports, period, and are like, that sounds dope. And then people who are just like former football players like myself. I did football and I wrestled. And I just found this and I was like, oh, this is cool.
The scene in the dojo is rather intimidating. 12 members are gathered, and for the most part, these are very large guys. I'm 6'2", and I weigh about 225. These guys are dwarfing me. There are also a couple of men of very average size, and shockingly, two women are participating. Santana describes how people feel when they first come to Florida Sumo.
They're nervous because they see what they see on TV, these ginormous guys just banging into each other. And then when they actually come together and they sit down and they watch it, they go, oh, wow, there's, you know, like, there's women. There's weight classes on the amateur side. So you have guys 130 pounds versus a 400-pound guy or whatever the case may be. And they see, oh, there's no, you can't be like this if you do this. Everybody's involved in it. Everybody's into it. And they kind of feel like, oh, I'm part of something. And that's one of the big things that get people who are a little nervous to see this and go, all right, I feel cool. Like one of our best wrestlers, actually, Dustin, he's from Canada, himself, the guy in the pink mawashi, he did zero sports his entire life and just fell in love with this, started gaining weight, and now he's one of the best wrestlers in the country and probably one of the best, top three guys in Canada.
Dustin Hawkins is a 30-year-old Canadian who moved to Orlando in 2017. The monotony of the COVID quarantines drove him to find a new hobby.
During the pandemic, Florida opened up a lot sooner than a lot of the other states did. So when we got let out, I was really, really bored after sitting around for like 3+ years or whatever, however long it was. And then I went on Facebook looking for stuff to do, and Cornelius had an ad out to come to a practice. So I drove from Jacksonville down to Orlando, and I've been doing it ever since, and it's been about 6 years now.
The wrestling match itself is quite a spectacle. Two participants face each other about 5 feet away. They squat once, stand up, squat again, and then they stare each other down, face to face.
At that point, it was called Nisankyo. It was like the stare-off before the match. And basically, at that point, you're going through your final preparations. You're going, all right, this is my plan. This is going to be plan B. I know this guy is going to more likely do this, especially if you've wrestled against him before. You know, like, for example, like if I'm fighting Dustin, I know he's going to come off super low, and he's going to go straight for my throat. So I know, all right, I got to move. You know, I'm fighting Korn. Korn's going to be a strategist. He's barely going to hit me. He's going to try to see what I do. So I got to really make sure whatever I do, I go into it. So you really go through those last couple of seconds. And then once more, you stand up from the Sankyo, and you're getting ready to put your forward fist down on the ground. It's everything's gone. It gets quiet. Everything around you is quiet. The only thing you're thinking about is just what's going to happen in the next couple of seconds. And it's really relaxing, actually. It's very quiet.
The wrestlers each place both fists on the ground, and the referee, called a gyoji, starts the fight. Instantly, both wrestlers vault from a squatting position and slam into each other. It's like watching a pair of Mack trucks in a head-on collision. The goal is simple. Either lift both of your opponent's feet off the ground, send them onto the ground, or force them out of the ring. Despite its simplicity on the surface, sumo is a nuanced sport.
I would say the tangible benefits of practicing sumo is one of a connection between mind, body, and spirit.
That's Jonathan Pilgrim. He goes by the spiritual moniker Jiva. The Texas native travels between Gainesville and Orlando wrestling, living in an RV. He's something of a poet warrior in the sumo world.
When it comes to the kinesiology of the body, there are many different schools of thought and philosophies. There's many different physical cultures out there when it comes to the athletic performance. And when I examine sumo wrestling and the different types of bodies and how you can use your body in sumo wrestling, it seems to be very complete, especially when it comes to the lower body and the stability and in eating.
Jiva isn't kidding when he talks about eating. After wrestling, it's all these guys talk about. Body mass is such an integral part of sumo that eating is training.
A lot of the sports, you have to torture your body to get to the certain weight class, but it seems like sumo marries the traditional eat, drink, and be merry lifestyle that is what we all want to enjoy with the supreme mastery of the body at the same time. And so you get to eat as much as you want, and you get to work as hard as you want. And when you combine the two together, it just kind of becomes this beautiful, majestic playground of a performance.
When wrestling each other, members of Florida Sumo will temper their attacks to accommodate the differences in size. Dustin Hawkins recalls his first sumo match and how much a weight disparity influenced the outcome.
I got creamed. What happened was I was up against a much larger opponent because I was 330 at the time. I'm almost 400 now, so I've put on quite a bit since then. But I was up against a much larger opponent, and he just steamrolled me. He came right off the line and just walked right through me. I wasn't even there.
Do you remember the first match you won?
The first match I won? Yes. So in tournament, the first match I won was in Texas at the Mighty Eagle Team Tournament, where I shoved my forearm into the guy's Adam's apple and pushed him out.
After about an hour of wrestling, the club starts to unwind. Wrestlers aid each other in removing the mawashi, the 20-foot-long belt that's wrapped around their midsection like a bloated thong. They are analyzing and breaking down their performances, offering guidance on how to improve.
You went from a losing position, you turn around, and you have all your eyes going forward, hey, drop your butt. You had a good grip, and just keep driving your feet. At that point, don't try to toss him. Don't try to throw him. Come here, left here. Let's go straight. Yeah, because like you had him locked up so deep that you guys are turning each other around. The moment you turn him around, you try to kind of just do like a little turn thing, try to toss him. Hey, just go.
When this session concludes, the members of Florida Sumo will go home. The following day, they'll get up, put on their game faces, and go back to work. For wrestlers like Dustin Hawkins, they can't imagine getting through the week without looking forward to their next trip to the dojo.
I deal with a lot of anxiety issues, a lot of social anxiety. So being able to come here and like dress in literally nothing but a loincloth really gives me the confidence to like go about my life, go out in the world, and kind of put myself out there in a way that only sumo could have taught me to do.
That's all for today's edition of Engage. We want to remind you, discussions about redrawing congressional districts are taking place in Tallahassee. This could impact your vote and your representation. These lines could be drawn through your community. We'd love to see you on Thursday, April 16th at 6 p.m. as we present Central Florida Public Media's Engage in the Community, when we'll discuss Florida's efforts at congressional redistricting and talk about what it means for your neighborhood. The event will take place at the Osceola Council on Aging in Kissimmee. Seats will fill up fast, so go online to cfpublic.org to reserve your spot. I'm Richard Copeland, sitting in for Sharon Stone. Thank you for joining us. All Things Considered is coming up following NPR News.